Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk World Radio, we are welcoming back our good friend Kathy Kelly, wonderful peace activist, author, journalist, president of World Beyond War, numerous other titles, and we are talking in particular about a book called Our Journey from Afghanistan by Zar and Qasim. Kathy Kelly, welcome back to Talk World Radio.
Well, thank you, David, and I'm so glad you suggested this topic among others. What an accomplishment. I have to say that I'm a slow writer, and the time that it can take me to finally finish writing one article, Zarguna and Qasim sent us a book. They wrote a book in 1 month. They had their story is, it's such a circuitous route, really. You know, here's a young couple who grew up in Afghanistan under the first Taliban takeover. So imagine all the repression and fear, particularly when you're part of the most discriminated against minority, the Hazara Shia.
What's the date of that?
Oh, let's see. That would have been in the 1990s, I guess.
Okay.
And Afghanistan is just not on anybody's radar in many ways. So then you have 9/11 in the United States, and the United States decides, okay, Afghanistan is sheltering Osama bin Laden, so they go to war against Afghanistan. Oust the Taliban, and then a new group of warlords takes charge. So Zarguna's father has been killed by the first Taliban takeover. She's an orphan in a desperately poor family. The kids are so hungry. They're so cold in the winter. She's up at 3 o'clock in the morning herding the livestock. And this young girl manages, under the repression of these warlords, to get herself into a school and persist until she finally ends up graduating from university. So there's Zarguna, and Qasim is also struggling, you know, to try to get through just incredible displacement and family problems and loss. And he gets pretty well educated. And then the United States leaves and you get the second Taliban takeover. And then they're in trouble because they've spent so much time with Westerners, like myself, hosting us, helping us learn about this, you know, hidden place, you know, parting the curtains. So they've got to get out of town. They have to go. And they flee to Pakistan. And we think, okay, they're in a safe house, but it's a horrible spot. One of those overcrowded, you know, God knows what people were thinking of who designed this situation. So they get out of that. And at that point, a group of internationals said, look, we have girls from Afghanistan banging on our door saying, please get us out. We can't get ourselves into Pakistan. Can you set up the safe house? And they do. And they kept it going. It was just remarkable. It hummed compared to the other place. And we get, you know, we help these girls get out of Afghanistan and into Pakistan, but then they're kind of stuck because it takes a long time, but eventually they get to Portugal. But then the Portuguese language is not easy to learn. They, you know, have a lot of resettlement challenges, the Portuguese permaculturists, and that's sown all through this story. The permaculture is really crucial because, okay, David, I'm kind of rambling, but I have to also mention, in 2030, it's likely that Kabul, Afghanistan, will be the first city to run out of water. Gone, done, no more water. And so early on, these young teenagers figured out, we face another huge problem, environmental collapse. So they started learning from permaculture authorities who would come over and live with them and teach them irrigation and grafting and replanting and looking at which way the wind is coming and all these wonderful things and planning events that permaculture is, you know, renowned for. And one of the most renowned teachers taught them. So they're learning that. And then the permaculturists in Portugal, plus the ones in Australia, plus our group in the United States, we just kind of all combined and we were able to get them into a really wonderfully designed program in Portugal. So they've got four books in there. And somehow Zadaguna, who has always been a careful note taker and reflector, turned it into the book you now have in your hands.
Kathy Kelly, I've got a million questions out of that. One is about how you came to meet them and what you were doing in Afghanistan. And I visited you once when you were there. And because the way you've summarized this endless story very quickly here, it sounds as if the United States showed up, got rid of the bad guys, all was peace and harmony and tranquility. And then when the United States military left, trouble came back. It is a little more complex than that, right?
Oh, yeah. When you want to talk about warlords in Afghanistan, the number one warlord was the United States. So, after the experience in Iraq and realizing how the United States could totally decimate a respectable culture and then walk away from it, we realized, well, that same process is happening in Afghanistan. And so there were people who would keep lists. I was among them of Afghan atrocities. You could read antiwar.com and glean the alternative news and keep, wow, these night raids are terrible and the bombings and forced displacement. And meanwhile, the United States was spending at the height of the surge of US troops in Afghanistan, $2 million per year per soldier, US soldier in Afghanistan. And the only money going into Afghanistan was related to militarism. So, Afghans who are desperate started saying, okay, sign me up. I've got to feed my family. And the corruption plus a lot of human rights abuses were just rampant. So we knew this was going on, but we didn't really have an in, if you will, in Afghanistan. Where would you go? Who would you stay with? Who would you get to know? And then a number of us, aware of what was going on in Guantanamo, were doing a fast in Washington, D.C., a lengthy fast. I think it was a 24-day fast, maybe. And finally, Bob Cook with Pax Christi, Metro Pax Christi, called me and said, "Do you realize that a group of Afghan teenagers are fasting with you?" I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, if you'd read your emails," and okay, I do get behind on my emails. And so I realized, oh my gosh. And then Amy Goodman had these kids on her show. The technology wasn't so great then. Nobody ever heard of Zoom. But there they are, huddled around a cell phone in a pup tent. Afghan winters are brutally cold in the rural areas. They're in the Bamyan province. And they're talking with Amy. And so then our group with the fast said, well, we want to call them too. So we set up a microphone and we all got in a big circle and we're hearing the young Afghans. And Carmen Trotta, God bless him, he said, it's Martin Luther King's birthday today, January 15th. Do you think I should tell these kids about Martin Luther King? And I said, sure, go ahead. He mentions Martin Luther King, and immediately two or three of them start to give us memorized quotes in English from Martin Luther King's speech. Incredible. So we said, well, we'd like to get to know you. Now, I had a long history with the emergency surgical centers for victims of war in Iraq. And, we try to help raise funds and tour these wonderful people in the United States. So they had a hospital in Afghanistan. And they said, well, yeah, you can visit our hospital. So a couple of us went from Pakistan, hopped over to Afghanistan, visited the hospital, contacted the and they said, come again, we can get you on a UN flight to Bamyan. So that's how it started. And then we got to know them and They weren't safe in Bamiyan. They were too far ahead of the warlords, basically, in terms of understanding aspects of Western culture and having weird ideas about, ways to do the farming differently. They were just constantly harassed. And so we said, look, we'll rent a place in Kabul. You live there, but then when we come there with our delegations, we get to stay there too, right? So we'd all smash in and live together in this very primitive place. And then it became, a succession of primitive places. But think, not even a stand-up latrine, like two slits in the cement, or no stove. You just cook over a gas cylinder and no heat. And until there was solar energy, 2 or 3 days without electricity, it was primitive. But we learned and they taught us. So that was the coming together of what did we it was Voices in the Wilderness. And at the time, they were called the, but for the book club, we'll have to give some other name because it's not even safe to identify that name with the Taliban for
Well,
those who are still there. But they had to disband the entire, it's so sad, they had bundles of videos and photos and testimonies. But when the second Taliban takeover happened, it was so immediately repressive that for safety, they had to just disband the whole thing, took down the
the
website.
book that the that some of these wonderful people have produced is terrific. Our Journey from Afghanistan, A Story of Survival and Hope. And I want to mention that World Beyond War does these online book clubs with a series of four, events through a month. And next month, you're going to be on there, Kathy, together with the two authors, the three of you, talking with anybody who has questions about this book. And people can go to worldbeyondwar.org, sign up for the book club. We mail them the book and they get the Zoom link, etc. But I wanted, Kathy Kelly, while I have you on the program, to also talk about Gaza. Because what's happening in Gaza is perfectly predictable, has been predicted. You've done a longer fast in protest of this one than the fast you were just talking about in protest of another horror long ago. But it just keeps getting worse. And it keeps pushing the envelope on what you can imagine people can, tolerate and support and celebrate and lie about and still maintain that they are respectable, good leaders of the world.
It's pretty shameful. The Hague group called for an emergency summit in at The Hague, and 30 countries went.
And then in
But
Bogota.
yes, I'm so sorry, in Bogota, thank you. 30 countries went. Well, that, is no small thing, but when you go through, and you could just do a quick Google search and you get it, the economic information on each of those countries, with very few exceptions, they're all continuing their economic trade with Israel, with illegal Israeli settlements. The UN International Court of Justice ruling gave September 19th, that's the D-Day date, sorry, not D-Day, that's the deadline date. And at that point, the illegal settlement and occupation has to be dismantled. Well, there's no hint of moving in that direction. And according to the International Court of Justice ruling advisory opinion, there should be no military support. Well, even Ireland continues to allow the planes to land at Shannon Airport and bring military supplies and soldiers over to the region, and then they get to Israel. And there's a factory in Israel that's continuing to manufacture parts that are so important. And then Francesca, oh, I'm sorry, for weapons, parts for weapons. Francesca Albanese's report made it really clear that large conglomerate tech groups like Google and Amazon in the United States are enabling that hideous, pernicious surveillance and tracking. And so, David, I've been thinking a lot about the White Rose in Germany. Two young Germans, that incredible bravery. They had to know the risks they were taking, and they'd go out and paint slogans in the middle of the night in Munich, where they were university students, Hans and Sophie Scholl. And they would get together a small group and they'd mail out flyers and say, distribute these. And they'd make enormous copies and put stacks of flyers in their universities. And at one point, Sophie got extra energetic and she pushed the stack of flyers off the top ledge of a top floor in the Munich University. And a janitor saw her do it. So all these flyers are fluttering down, accusing the Nazi tyranny and saying, we will not be silent. And then they were arrested and 4 days later at the guillotine, they were both executed. Israel is executing every single grouping of witnesses. 210 journalists have been executed. And many more maimed and displaced and burned and threatened and harassed. The doctors, whose witness is crucial, are taking their lives in their hands if they just say, look at my destroyed hospital. Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, on his 7th month of being held in solitary confinement, beaten so badly he might lose one eye, lost like 30 pounds. He gets one meal a day, maybe, and sometimes that's just 2 spoonfuls of rice. But other doctors assassinated, their families wiped out, doctors and nurses, ambulance crews, and 1 12-year-old boy, Mohammed Bardawil, witnessed the shooting of a large number of ambulance crew rescue workers. Their vehicles turned up in March of 2025. To try to rescue some other people, and the Israeli forces opened fire on them, shot them in their torsos and heads, and this little boy just witnessed it. And so people were questioning him, trying to investigate. He's standing by the seashore, and he was assassinated. How do they track the 12-year-old, the doctors? How do they know when the doctor is not on the shift at the hospital and is at home? It's using the technology that Google and Amazon and Palantir supply.
As if the shame of IBM having provided the technology to the Nazi death camps was not some sort of a lesson, as if we didn't grow up hearing over and over again for decades, never again, we'll never do anything like this again, we're ashamed and have learned. And yet, no. And as we speak, Kathy, if I look at the website of CNN, there's this headline. The wars that Trump promised to end are escalating. Why? And I want to scream. I haven't read the article because you have to pay money to CNN, but I just want to scream at them. The wars that Trump promised to end and is shipping weapons to every day are escalating. I wonder why.
And then they showcase these weapons so that they can sell more. Who is benefiting? Well, the Israeli stock market is over the top. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Electric, General Atomics, RTX. Why end the war? They're making so much money. And then Netanyahu, if he loses the very, very right-wing extremists in the Knesset, he's out, and then he could trot off to jail, which is, or The Hague. And so there's a lot of invested interest in prolonging a hideous war. And when you think of people who are, for instance, surgeons and can't stand to do the surgery because they're so weakened, or that four groups with media in Gaza have said, our people can't report. They're too weak to get out and try to cover the story. The starvation was predictable, but it certainly now is happening. It's a charnel house. And we're watching. We're watching on our screens. And yet, I do have to say that around the world, there are large demonstrations. And even now, in front of the United Nations, As the United Nations deliberates about a two-state solution, which I believe would be no kind of a solution, there are large numbers of people that are congregating and saying, stop the words, take action. A group went over to the Egyptian consulate last week, and their chant was, starving children cannot wait, open up the Rafah gate. People are on to the corruption. And this idea that you can get Egypt and Qatar and Jordan together and they'll do airdrops, that's the worst possible solution. Some of the pallets fall on people's heads and kill them, and the trucks are backed up. The UN, UNRWA, they know how to do this. But it's the political will that's missing. And, I listen, you can listen in on all of these UN meetings now. And Mary Robinson, former president of Ireland, one of the co-directors of the Elders, she gave a very good speech. And she's saying what's really true, but you can hear it said again and again. They have to stop the trade. They have to stop the shipments. They can suspend Israel from the United Nations. They can shun and scorn Israel. They do it in words, but they can give teeth to it. The Hague Group is a start, but I do want to say this is no time to give up. Lean in on this issue. And all around the world, as we saw with the peace wave, it's almost funny, David, you and the IPB, International Peace Bureau, said, now focus on nuclear weapons, and everybody focused on Gaza. But I think that's true. Don't just denounce war in general, denounce this war.
And everyone is desperate for action, so desperate that people want to, mirror the criminality, want to send in war makers, want to send in armed troops to fight the Israelis, rather than, or out of frustration with our inability thus far to get boycott, divestment, sanctions, prosecution, upholding of the rule of law. Netanyahu snuck into my town here last week to visit Thomas Jefferson's slave plantation, and snuck back out, and then flew off to Israel. This was on his way out of the United States, and didn't tell anybody until after he'd come. But why did they have to let him in and not arrest him? They have a legal duty to arrest him. These 12 countries in Bogota that make no weapons, that are committed to not arming Israel, and also to not trading with Israel, which you say they are nonetheless doing, this is like the closest we come to the rule of law. And it gives people these fantasies about balances of power and spheres of influence and a multipolar world and so forth. And we've forgotten the very idea of a universal world where we hold everybody to the same standards and the same laws because nobody's even pretending to make that happen, at the level of our governments.
Well, David, I have to say, I think it's a conundrum because I want to say to the world governments, take action. And I do see an action that I think is viable, but it's experimental. And I guess I have to say to myself, this is no time to be recommending experiments. But the experiment is also flagged by Francesca Albanese. There are unarmed civilian peacemaking groups in Palestine now. They're in the West Bank, and they do have effect. When the settlers come to harass a town that's got internationals living there, and the internationals go out, I think they have a siren on their car or something, the settlers disperse. The Israeli military supports some of these harassing and murderous settlers who steal sheep and set fire to farms. So if the, but this is where I have to say this may be no time for experiments, but if the United Nations were to say, yes, we're going to send in peacekeeping groups, no tanks, no weapons, and then opened up for civil society to send contingents, I think there are, if the money was there to facilitate it, I think you'd find many, many, many people willing to go in, take up residence, but they'd have to not drain the area of all of its food and water. It would take some, but there are groups who have been thinking about this for a long time. And certainly the United Nations could facilitate a massive intervention without weapons if at the same time it was suspending Israel from the United Nations and encouraging absolutely no more weapons. Now, Dr. Feroz Tzidwa, a very eminent surgeon who just got back from Gaza, he says, look, there's only one thing that needs to happen. Trump picks up the phone and says, we're done, no more weapons.
Yes.
We're partnering with this. So there's the conundrum. Do we try to experiment with something massive and new at a time when people are already falling down on the streets out of starvation? Do we just lean in on Trump and think that he's the magic solution? Do we try to hope the United Nations could make a difference?
Well, I think one part of the answer, and we have 2 minutes left, Kathy Kelly, is that it's not entirely new and it's not a brand new experiment. And the United Nations has done unarmed peacekeeping and found it more successful than armed peacekeeping. And I will put links at
Love
Talk World
that.
Radio with this show to the books and videos and full-length films and reports and articles. And lists of successful uses around the world for decades of unarmed civilian defense, because it's,
Okay.
yes, it's of course dramatically less known and doesn't have a single Hollywood movie to its credit, but it's not brand new.
Well, thank you. I was thinking of the massive form that it would take. But, we should certainly remind people that Edward Horgan was an Irish militarist, really, and he had a very big conversion, and he was a part of a number of those unarmed civilian protection forces. And then he's on the board for World Beyond War, and also Dr. John Ruhr has certainly tried his best to create a group that would go to Zaporizhia. So it has been thought about, it has been explored. I do hope that we'll preserve the unity of our peacemaking groups. I don't want to pick a fight and be separated from people I've worked with for so many years. But this is, well, it's kind of, like a relationship. You have to work to keep it going.
Indeed, you do. And the problem is the people doing nothing, and the people shipping the weapons, and the people using the weapons. But we got to change all of that. Kathy Kelly, you're doing wonderful work. Thank you for everything. You keep pushing and for coming on Talk World Radio.
And I help to make David patient because I drive him nuts and he becomes patient. Thank you.
I'm not sure how that works, but I'm not sure I'm patient. But thank you, Kathy.
Bye-bye.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.